Rage 105 Radio. Women making waves.
Susie?
Yes?
Do you ever buy pre-loved clothing?
I love the way you ask me that, because I think you ask that question knowing, or you think you know the answer to the question already,
don't
you?
Yeah, I do. I do think I know.
But you're going to be wrong, because only a couple of days ago, I did buy two items from a pre-loved shop.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, I did. Do you actually, Linda? That's the question as well.
Well, in the past, I have been known to buy things from charity shops. You know, you can, if you rustle around there, you can find some real finds in some charity shops. When I was younger and trying to be kind of trendy and slightly different, I did used to buy things out of charity shops, because back then, you know, the things that you were finding were from probably 20 years before, which were very different. I remember buying big shirts and things like that, men's shirts that were quite long and sort of way past your bottom, you know, way, way past. I would wear that with a belt and dark glasses and a hat.
So that's interesting. It's nice to hear that. I'm going to say something nice about you, Linda, here. But it's nice because you're very experimental. So you have confidence to mix certain things.
Well, not now. Not so much now, but I used to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got really, really staid and boring, to be quite honest, Susie.
That's interesting.
Which is not a good thing.
Well, yes, good or not. But I tell you what I really love about pre-loved clothes shops and charity shops is you get some really interesting stuff. And it doesn't matter now, does it, that it's 20 years ago that the clothes are coming in? Because fashion changes even quicker than it used to. That used to be quite sort of select, and where in all the decades would have certain styles. But now you can mix the decades up, can't you?
Do you know what? I used to dabble with acting, as you know, when I was younger. And theatre wardrobes were great places to borrow items of clothing and other things from. Hats and bits and bobs and pieces of clothing, you know, 1940s bits of clothing, all that kind of thing. It's remarkable what you can do if you just kind of think a little bit outside the box.
Yeah, outside the box. Now, question is, do you think women do that more than men? Think outside the box when it comes to clothes?
Yeah, I think women have more courage in what they're wearing than men do.
Interesting.
It's very much a generalisation, but I'm talking about the majority of men. You know, you get men that aren't like that. But very much so, I think men are scared of ridicule, whereas women are far more experimental in wanting to try things out.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I was having, and I shouldn't really tell this online, but I really did have this conversation with my husband a couple of weeks ago. We were thinking what priorities we have in life. And for me, I love cars, but he loves his cars, and he has one in particular that he really enjoys. Oh, I shouldn't say that, actually, but he loves cars.
A favourite car. It's a bit favorite like a favourite child, isn't it, really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Where I, as much as I love cars, I love clothes. And if it means buying something a little bit different from a pre-loved shop, I get really excited about it. And I kept saying to Sam, but that is one of my priorities. I really enjoy wearing something that I like and I really enjoy being in. Does that sound a bit weird?
No, it doesn't. I think most women in the world would agree with you. But Susie, do you get rid of something when you buy something new? Or have you an ever-expanding wardrobe where you've got to build extensions to your house continually?
No. Well, I mean, yes. But I have started to get rid of my clothes now. Because they say, don't they, if you haven't worn an item for at least a year, get rid of it. And what do you do, Linda? Mm. You're laughing here.
No, I do try my best to get rid of them. But there are some items of clothing from the past I'm really struggling to get rid of. I have a dress that I love. I haven't worn it for 30 years.
Oh,
how ridiculous
is
that?
I know.
And it's beautiful. And it was really expensive at the time. And I can't bear to get rid of it, Susie.
Interesting.
I wouldn't be able to fit into that thing in a month of Sundays.
That's so interesting, Linda. So what's it going to take for you to pull that dress out of that wardrobe and give it to somebody else that would enjoy it?
Burglary, I think. a burglar coming in and taking it is probably what's required. You should leave the key under the mat for you, Susie.
I think we're going to have to work on that one. We're just blinking down. I mean, I need to have a look at that. Well, on that note, we have a couple of really interesting guests, don't we, today?
We do. We have Jane Horwood as a guest today. She is the founder of pre-loved clothing boutique Trash Chic. Can't wait to speak to her today.
And then we've got our second guest, Joanna Borrett. She is a composer and she's just announced the world premiere of her most recent work. Oh, I'm so excited. As they say, it's quite rare to get some women composers on our show, isn't it?
It is. Under 8% of composers are women. So there you go. Two exceptional women joining us today.
You're listening to Women Making Waves radio show and podcast, brought to you by Susie Thorpe and Linda Ness. This show is all about women doing extraordinary things.
Cambridgeshire-based Joanna Borrett studied cello in London and Moscow, and she formed and was artistic director of Peterborough String Orchestra. Recently, Joanna has turned her hand to composing, and her gorgeous work combines elements of both classical and folk music. Thank you for joining us on Women Making Waves today, Joanna.
Thank you for inviting me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Oh, you're very welcome. We'll just start to be nosy right at the beginning. How old were you when you started playing the cello, Joanna?
Oh, that's not an embarrassing question. I was 10, but that's actually quite late if you're going to be professional. But I did stop piano at 7, so that's a bit better. And I still love playing the piano and the cello, come to that, yeah.
So you weren't one of these children that had to be marched to the music lesson, you know, and told to practice every single day by your mum and dad? Or there was none of that going on. You were keen, were you?
Yes, I was. I don't know why, but I did. Something about it resonated with me right from the beginning. I did love practicing. I used to make up stories, even for the studies that I played, especially on the piano. And if I couldn't get something right, it did bother me when I was at school, even at primary school. So yes, for some reason, I felt quite committed to it from the beginning.
Were you the perfect student, Joanna?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
I didn't really start practicing seriously on the cello until I was 14 and I went to music school. But from then on, I was very committed to practicing. But as for other things, no, I wasn't. I mean, I would get away with as little academic work as I could. I went to music school for 2 years, and actually at the time you didn't need to do many O levels. And then I went and did an A-level music course, and I used to go around the National Gallery to look at paintings instead of coming to my lessons. And I had all sorts of stupid adolescent ideas, which now seem very embarrassing, and I think I must have been a total pain in the neck. But I did work on the cello. I did work on music, and I've always read masses, especially the classics, especially the Russian Romantic classics. So I had a sort of internal commitment, but it wasn't always what I was meant to be doing at school.
How did your family feel when you decided to make music your career? Was that, kind of, oh, hooray, or, oh, you should take up typing just in case?
I'm not sure totally. I think they sort of thought it was good and then realised how difficult it was to do well in any of the arts and had second thoughts. But the good thing about my parents is that although they weren't professional musicians, they absolutely loved the arts. So right from an early age, they took me and my sister to art galleries, concerts, theatre. I went to my first opera when I was 9, for example, and they encouraged us. Obviously, they paid for lessons from an early age. They just thought that whole side of the world was wonderful. They came from a working class background, but they were both very intelligent and they just genuinely loved all of that. So I think this is what I think about other people. When people often see classical music as something difficult or maybe something even upper class, actually, you don't need to know anything to love classical music. It's often that you just haven't been introduced to it right from the beginning. And if you are, I don't really see how you can't love it.
I find that extraordinarily wonderful to hear, because you do hear these days how sometimes opera and the ballet is inaccessible to lots of people, and they still think there's a hierarchy about how, I suppose it could be down to the actual venues more than anything else. Is that right, do you think, Joanna?
I think all of it can be perceived as very exclusive. I have definitely, even recently, been to classical music concerts where I know the piece. Not only do I know the piece being played, I've performed it, and we've got great national reviews. And I felt I don't really fit in here in the audience because it seems so academic and it has a certain sort of atmosphere that I don't warm to. So I can completely understand that. I think you need to try not to internalize those sort of approaches. And I'm not actually quite sure where they've come from, because I don't think it's quite like that. I mean, for example, when I was studying in Moscow, people in the street would just stop you if you were carrying a cello and say how wonderful and how marvelous you were. And everybody went to classical concerts. It was different. And I think it's a bit different in Italy and Germany too. I mean, I'm not really the expert to talk on that. So I think it is more associated with class in the UK. And I don't really know why that is, but I think it's a great pity.
You ended up, as you just mentioned, studying at the Conservatoire in Moscow. How did that happen? Did you speak Russian? And you mentioned earlier you liked reading Russian classics. Was it always a place you fancied?
Yeah, I think, again, as I said, I was a bit of a bolshy teenager, and I read all the Russian classics, particularly Dostoevsky. I absolutely loved it. And at the time, I thought communism was a great thing because I knew absolutely nothing about it. So I was just thinking, oh, this is marvellous. And they also had the highest technical standard in the world. So I was with a very good cello teacher. And so I applied. The only way you could get there at the time, since 1976, was through a British Council scholarship. So I applied and I went through that. I mean, it was amazing to start with. And then I got desperately homesick. It was the first time I'd left home. So after the first few months, I got incredibly homesick. And so it was a really tough experience for me, actually. I don't know about regretting it, because it's too late to regret things. But it came back with me feeling very insecure about my playing, because technically the standard over there was phenomenally good, way above what I could do.
Well, that's incredible. And how long did you find that, when you're coming back from Moscow, did you find that you could get back into your step and really flourish in a way that you thought that you weren't doing in Moscow?
Well, I suppose it's very gradual. I don't know that I've ever really felt that confident on the cello, if I'm really honest. I don't think
really?
I have. And actually, I know,
wow.
I know, I mean, I think that's another thing about the classical music world. I don't think I'm alone in this. I think there's such a perfectionism that, you know, it's quite hard to feel really secure about it. But gradually, obviously, there was quite a low point when I got back, and I gradually built my confidence up. But I've always been much happier playing in chamber music than playing solo stuff, which I found terrifying and much too revealing. Although I have done some solo stuff, and in fact, I did a Wigmore Hall solo recital, which got very good reviews, but I was petrified, and I knew I couldn't spend a life doing anything like that. But I've always liked chamber music, and particularly playing in string orchestra. That's the thing I've really loved the most, where you're one of 12, and so you're not so revealed, and it's not technically so demanding, and it's much easier to just share the whole music making with other people.
And in 1983, you formed the Peterborough String Orchestra. How did that come about, Joanna?
Well, it took over 2 years of work going up and down. I was living in North London then, trying to persuade the Development Corporation, businesses, Peterborough City Council, the arts associations, that it would be a good idea to have an orchestra resident. I think the Peterborough Development Corporation at that time, they had done some amazing things to Peterborough. And so the idea was there would be 12 young players resident in the city, and it would complement all the other great things they developed. Like at the time, Queensgate Shopping Centre had just won an award for the best shopping centre in Europe. And Ferry Meadows is a wonderful facility for sports and nature. And so this would be something for the arts. And so they gradually did get behind it and supported it and gradually won other people around. But there were certainly lots of moments before it happened where it almost fell through. The Musicians Union also were very supportive as well, because it was creating new jobs.
That sounds like a lot of work, actually, a lot of pulling things together and a lot of admin as well, not just the music side, but the organising.
Yeah, no, it was. Yeah, but I think it was quite good for me because I've always been really quite shy and quiet. And I suddenly started to talk about this orchestra and everyone started sort of saying, oh, you're so positive, you're so dynamic. And I thought, oh, that's good. Am I? Oh, that's good. I quite like to be like that. So, you know, I started to feel, yes, I can be this person. I can be this dynamic, you know, an entrepreneurial person. So I think it was good for me. But anything you do in the arts is a massive level of work and you have to be a bit mad or a bit obsessive to do it.
Joanna, how important is it to have classical music around us?
I suppose a lot of things like that sort of question are very hard to assess. In fact, probably all the most important things, like, you know, how happy are you, or how important is it to be loved, or how important is this, they're not that easy to calculate. I think all of the arts are absolutely wonderful and absolutely essential for people, but obviously they're not essential in as much as food and water are essential. But I think a culture that doesn't have that is going to have a horrible emptiness about it. I mean, if you think about what city might you want to visit, it would almost certainly be cities that have wonderful things. And art lasts. You know that saying, life's short, art's long. Art lasts hundreds of years. It has something truthful about it and beautiful that tells us about ourselves. So if you cut that out of your life, I don't know what really is. I don't know how to explain that, but I think it is essential.
I would almost think it's almost a chasm, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's an emptiness about it. I mean, to me, immediately as I'm saying that, I'm thinking of George Orwell's book 1984 with a newspeak, where you gradually cut unessential words out of language. And that's the sort of world I'm thinking of, an emptiness, because all of these things, love, passion, imagination, creativity, are the things that really do make life worth living. And the arts are a passionate expression of strong feeling. That's what they're about. And at their best, they have truth about them and they connect people to each other in a way it's quite hard to get in any other way.
Good description. So,
and they're inspiring, and they really are inspiring, and they can change lives.
Fairly recently, you've turned your hand to composing. That come about? Why didn't you want to do that when you were younger? Do you think it's something that people grow into?
No, I don't know. Again, this is another question that I don't really know the answer to. I do know that when I was younger, and maybe it's sometimes the way classical music is taught, I had this, you know, veneration of composers, and I still do, the really great composers. But I just had in my mind that unless you were a genius, and like Mozart, you were composing symphonies at the age of 6, there was no point being a composer, and it was this incredibly difficult thing. And of course, when I was younger, it wasn't really acceptable for women to compose anyway. So I just had it totally blanked off in my head. And then I suppose a few years ago, I dropped out of music more or less for about 20 years, out of playing anyway. And then I came back to it and had a duo with a violinist, and he started doing arrangements and he got me involved in that. And the minute I started to do it, I loved it. And I started to make up introductions and middle sections and new endings and turn the tune around. But I still didn't think of it as composing. And then I suppose when I came back to music, I also started to challenge things that you don't traditionally get taught in the classical way, like improvising and playing by ear. So I taught all of that. And somehow that all came together. And when my twin grandsons were born, so that's 6 years ago, when I saw them for the first time, they looked so vulnerable. I thought, oh, I'm going to write them a little piece. And that was the first piece I composed. And I finally had the confidence to actually think, yes, I can do this. I will do this. And so it's very recent. And then over the next few years, I wrote a few pieces now and again for cello and piano. And then 2.5 years ago, I thought, oh, well, I've got eight. I'll send them off to publishers. And that went far better than I expected. And I've now got two publishers. And one of them, Kevin Mayhew, I was asked to be an in-house composer. And then the second book I started writing for them, while I was composing it, I sort of had a very strong feeling, I think this is really a string orchestra piece. And that's Clan. And I wrote that for string orchestra, so I arranged it again for string orchestra. And I now feel that, yes, string orchestra is the main thing I really want to write for. But overall, I'm writing mainly for strings because that's the sound I like the best and it's what I know the best. And at this stage in my life, I mean, I'm 67 now, I think I need to stick with what I know. Maybe if I'd started composing in my 20s or 30s, I might have wanted to do other types of music as well, but I think I'd rather really just do this as well as I can.
I've read somewhere, Joanna, that it says that you are the composer that's changing the perception and bringing classical music to a younger and cooler audience. Now, I mean, that sounds wonderful. Are you pleased with that sentence?
I am, but I don't know that it's actually true. I mean, I would love to think that was true. I really don't know. I mean, I think whoever wrote that might mean is that I am writing in a more traditional way with tunes, a lot of classical music. It's quite fashionable to write music that's atonal or serial or electronic. And, well, what I want to write is just good tunes. And so I think it's very straightforward and it's quite easy to understand what the music's about, because in my head, when I compose something, I need to have a clear idea of what I want to say and what I think the music's about, even if I can't put that in words. But I think that is an amazing sentence and I really wish it was true. I hope it was true. I hope it might be true one day.
You mentioned your composition, Clan, and I've listened to it. It's great. We're listening at the moment to a track called Real. It is very Scottish sounding, actually.
Yeah.
Is that something that you did when you were... Have you lived up there?
Scottish, no. I'm really just right by instinct, but I do love Scotland, especially the Highlands. And I'm not alone in that. And so when I started writing Clan, I had been asked to write a book which had a theme, and I was thinking of a theme, and then I suddenly thought, what if it doesn't have a theme? What if the whole book just tells a story, but each movement also works individually? And then when I thought of that, I then suddenly thought, oh, I'll set it in Highlands. And then I immediately thought of three different films, Braveheart, Hidalgo, Dances with Wolves. And I had a romantic idea about it. And of course, like with anything you're creating, you put a lot of your own experience and background into it as well. And so I wrote it like that, but I had lots of sort of visions of the Highlands in my head. I wish I did have some Scottish blood. Unfortunately, I don't. But no, I did really enjoy writing it. It's the only piece I've written that has almost seemed like it's taken off and has just written itself.
Am I right in saying that this album, this piece of work, that it says here that it was formed to shine a light on music written by women? Is that correct, Joanna?
No, that's the string group who are giving the first performance are a group called Her Ensemble, and they are a group who have already recorded it, and they are for gender minorities. They're a new group. They promote women's music, music by women composers. And Ellie Conster runs the group. And she was inspired to do that during lockdown when she saw the statistic that I think it was in 2019 of all the music composed over the whole world in concerts, only 3% of it, the music played in concerts, was by women. So her group is just music by women, and it's a group of gender minorities. So that's women, non-binary people and trans people.
You mentioned earlier on that back in the day, women just didn't compose. There just weren't any women composers. I find that really interesting. And as you're saying, there's a very low percentage now of women composers. I wonder why that is. It doesn't really make any sense, does it?
Yes. I mean, I think there were women composers, but no one really heard of them. There have definitely been some excellent women composers, but no one had heard of them. I remember actually asking one of my teachers, why aren't there any women composers? And they said, well, I think it's because women's creativity goes into having children and bringing up children. And that's why they can't put their creativity into composing, which was actually a completely acceptable answer. That's so back in the 1970s. That was mm-hmm. I think, a general thing. But of course, that would seem totally ludicrous today, wouldn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, it would a bit. I had to stop myself from really laughing.
And I mean, it doesn't really make sense of why there are so many famous women authors, I suppose there aren't as many well-known women painters, but there certainly have been in the past. Some of it is that I think that there probably were, but maybe some of the music's lost. I think this is what Ellie's group, her ensemble, is finding some of these manuscripts that maybe haven't been played, because the whole process of composing a piece is just really the start. You have to get it played by a good professional group. It costs money, usually, or you have to have very good connections. And if you're prejudiced against, it can easily just get put in a manuscript and maybe lost forever. Or maybe lost for several hundred years till someone finds it again. It's promotion, marketing is a big part of it. It's not just writing something good.
Yeah, and having to push yourself forward, which I think historically women have not been the best at.
No.
It's from the boardroom and everywhere else. You know, we're not very good at that kind of
thing. No. But I mean, I think it's great. I think in society in general, so many things are so much better now. And that applies to the classical music world as well. I mean, more women composers is one of the things. And I think a lot of things are changing in a more positive way.
And I think her ensemble is a shining light, isn't it, really, about women in music, and good for them. I think the perception needs to change. And as Linda touched on, promotion and marketing. I think sometimes we all, women at the time, didn't think they were good enough to be promoted, or didn't think that they, almost a sort of an imposter moment, felt that, you know, they write music, but hey, they're not as good as they ought to be. And so I think that needs to change too. But I think it is changing. So I don't want to be too dumb.
I definitely agree with that. And I struggle with that too. I still struggle to see myself as a composer. I mean, it is fairly recent for me. I think women generally do struggle with confidence much more than men. They do. I'm not quite sure why that is. But I'm starting to just relax about it more a bit.
And I notice on Facebook that you give bite-sized lessons on the cello free of charge. What made you start doing that? That's a great idea, actually.
Yeah, that's improvising. Yes. Well, as I said, I think there is, I'm not sure why this is, there has been a huge lack of connection between learning an instrument and being able to play by ear and improvise. And if you were learning folk, you definitely would learn to play by ear right away, and you'd probably also start to become more confident at improvising. And in Baroque times, for example, all instrumentalists were just taught to improvise from the beginning, and you were even expected to improvise during concerts. But for some reason, I don't know why, that skill has almost vanished. It's almost taboo. So it's something I taught myself when I came back into music, how to improvise, how to play by ear, because I suddenly realised, well, it's ridiculous. I've been learning all this time. And if you ask me to play Happy Birthday on the cello without the music, or on the piano, or anything, Auld Lang Syne, any simple tune, you know, I wouldn't be able to do it without the music, which is absolutely mad, really. So I taught myself to play by ear, and I taught myself to improvise. And because it's been so literally liberating for me. And for me, it's led into composing. And I also think it helps with interpretation as well. I thought that I would offer it on my Facebook page as a free resource for classical musicians. It's mainly aimed at cello, but it would work for any string instrument because it is actually so easy when you understand the basics. I mean, if you can play a scale, if you can play an arpeggio, you can really compose a very, very simple or improvise a very, very simple tune. And you have to memorize scales and arpeggios from grade one. So it's ridiculous that it's not easier. Most people can't do this, really.
Amazing. It's been really, really great chatting to you today, Joanna Borrett. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
All the best with your future endeavours. I know you've got a lot of exciting things coming up.
Fantastic. Thank you, Joanna. It's been really lovely. Thank you.
Thanks very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And within that interview, you heard two tracks from Clan composed by Joanna, One Morning and Real.
You're listening to Women Making Waves radio show and podcast, brought to you by Susie Thorpe and Linda Ness. This show is all about women doing extraordinary things.
Our guest today is Jane Horwood, who is the founder of the pre-loved clothing boutique Trash Chic. Now, with her wonderful choice of colours and style, Jane, a web designer turned fashion connoisseur, has created something quite interesting. Perhaps an agenda to re-evaluate how we buy and regenerate clothes, how to reuse and to reinvent. Now, from an early age, Jane has adored clothes, printing fabric, making her own clothes for selling at Camden Market, supplying a range of clothes to Harrods, and this is the bit I really, really love, made a shirt for Alison Moyer's appearance in Top of the Pops, to name but a few. Jane, welcome to Women Making Waves.
Hi there.
Oh, very nice to have you on the show today. Now, I just want to start off, why do you like clothes so much?
I think it all started back when I was a goth and a punk. Growing up in Wales, a lot of the clothes there were quite boring. People wore boring things. It was very hard to get anything interesting. I think I just liked a little bit of drama. When I went to London and, you know, there were so many different fashions around, I just thought, you know, this is great. Also, I think I kind of hid a little bit behind the clothes because I was very shy. So actually just donning some really great costume, although oddly enough, I mean, then it makes you stand out, doesn't it? But, you know, it's almost like a bit of armour, really, because I think people are looking at that and maybe you feel they're not looking at you as much, you know, they're looking at what you're wearing.
For me, I think what it shows about lots of people like you and colours and is a personality that I think comes through in that. What I have been reading about from you is that your mother was very into clothes as well, Jane.
Well, she certainly made a lot of clothes, yeah, and she was quite fashionable, actually. But you see, I remember her coming to the schoolyard and wearing something that would embarrass me, like a strange hat. Looking back, it was something that was actually very on trend. Because the other mothers were not dressing like that, some of them were even coming down to the schoolyard in their slippers, you know? And my mum would trot in something, you know, rather glamorous. I don't know. I just felt awkward about it, which is strange, isn't it, really?
And when you were, you know, a punk and a goth, what was your mum making of that? Did she like that? Did she encourage you? Or was she kind of like, oh, you can't go out like that?
Well, I mean, I had left home then. Because I left home when I was 17. So I was up in London. While I was up there, I mean, she couldn't really do anything about it. But she didn't like the clothing I was wearing. And I do remember coming back to Newport on the train one weekend. And she just took one look at me and, you know, it was like, oh, God, you know, you're really embarrassing me.
Oh, the tide had turned.
But yeah, exactly. It had, didn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
But you weren't dressing for Wales and dressing for London. You just kind of thought, right, this is me and I'll be like that wherever I am now.
I mean, the thing is, I did have, you know, sort of sensible jobs, as it were. So I couldn't really go into jobs like when I was working in advertising. I mean, I couldn't go in there wearing sort of such crazy things. But as soon as I was out, then that's what I would be doing. And I'd be making stuff up as well, you know, just getting fabric, and I couldn't really afford to buy the clothes I wanted. I mean, certainly things like Vivienne Westwood I liked, but I mean, there was no way I was going to be able to shop there. So I would just go into shops, look at the stuff very carefully. I mean, then, of course, no mobile phones, so you couldn't be taking quick pictures of things. I'd have to remember, you know, what it looked like, and then go away, try and get a pattern that I could adapt, perhaps. I mean, again, it would be very cheap fabric, always doing stuff on the cheap, and, you know, and make the costume up. Often the stuff was not very well made, I have to say. I mean, it would last an evening or something for a party, and then that would be it. But I didn't mind that, really.
And when you were in London, were you sort of part of the music scene as well? Were you going out to see Susie and the Banshees and the Slits and you know, the Skids, bands like that at the time?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was so cheap to do that then as well.
Yeah.
I look at the price of, you know, tickets now to see bands, and it's horrifying.
I know.
But then everything was really cheap. Yeah, and there were some great venues, you know, the Hammersmith Odeon. Well, Hammersmith Palais as well, I think, the venue, the Rainbow. I think that was at Finsbury Park. Yeah, we were always doing that. And also smaller bands as well that were playing in the back of pubs and things like that.
What would you say has been your favourite era in fashion? What do you think has been the most successful?
Well, for me personally, I just love being a goth. I just loved all the black and the chains. And yeah, that for me was my favourite. That would be my favourite time.
And you set up your own clothing label, influenced by Vivienne Westwood. Did you meet her at any point?
I didn't. And you know what? Years later, I discovered that a friend of mine who worked for the BBC, if he's listening to this now, he'll be embarrassed. But he had some tickets to go to a Vivienne Westwood fashion show. And he didn't realise that I liked her and took a different friend. And I honestly, I can't to this day understand why. But anyway, that happened. So, no, I didn't meet her. But what I loved was the fact that, you know, there was just this feeling that you could make something from nothing and that anybody could do it, you know. So just picking up bits of things from the street or bones or whatever it was, clothing, you know, with rips. It was just being inventive, really, about stuff. And that's why I just thought, oh, you know, I'm just going to have a go at this, because I hated the job I was in. I was working in an advertising agency and it was a big mistake. I'd gone there, and as soon as I got there, even the very first day, I realised, oh, you know, what have I done? This is not for me. I was kind of stuck there for a few months. And in the end, I just thought, I'm never going to get out of here, really. So what I better do is just work for myself. So I just thought, well, what have I always wanted to do? Make clothes. I'll do that. Mm. And that's what I did. And so I just went in and just resigned. They were a bit shocked. What are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to, you know, have a stall on Camden Market. What? You know. So I just, yeah, I just started doing that, really. It was a bit mad now looking back. But I think I've always done things like that, really. I've just thought, oh, I want to have a go at this. Let's have a go. What's the worst that can happen?
Camden Market. I loved Camden Market at that point. It was just such a great place to be, though, wasn't it? And Greenwich Market as well.
I did Greenwich too, when it very, very first opened.
Out of interest then, Jane, when you left your job in advertising and you took that big step to own your own income, I suppose, in many ways, was it a little bit scary about where you were going to go? Or did you have enough ideas that you could gather enough sort of merchandise to start selling? I mean, what was it like being your own person, your own business at that time?
The daughter of one of the guys at the ad agency, she was an artist, and she said to me, oh, well, you know, I'd like to do something like that, so maybe I can come up with some designs for fabric. So we actually printed our own fabric, and we were using calicos and, you know, the cheapest fabric we could get. So really, really bright colours, big flowers and things on them. That wasn't very gothic at all. And yeah, we just started from that, really. Yeah, just thought, well, you know, we'll try Camden Market. It was a bit scary, I suppose, but I didn't think about it too much, because initially I was working at the ad agency in the day, and then at night I was going back and we were making all this clothing. But it was quite funny, because the paint we were using was really, really quite toxic, and we didn't realise at the time. So we had all this. I had a little bedsit in West Hampstead. You know, the paints were out there and we were cutting away and, you know, making the clothes with all the paints and the clothes drying on rails and things around the little bedsit. And I was awake for about, I don't know, about 4 or 5 days on the trot. I didn't get any sleep at all. And I just thought, oh, wow, this is exciting. You know, this is, you know, I'm obviously on a high with the new business. And then what we realized, well, it was the paint. It was almost like sniffing glue. Oh. We were both high as kites.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Did you realise that at the time, or was it someone sort of...
Well, somebody came in, some friends of mine that I'd worked with before wanted to come and see what we were doing. So I said, oh, yeah, pop along, you know. So they walked in and they were said, my goodness me, what the heck is going on in here? And they were really quite shocked and their eyes were almost watering. But of course, because it had been a steady build up for us, I suppose, we didn't think about it, you know. So that was quite amusing.
What materials did you use instead? Did you have to sort of think it?
No. We just continued with it, but we opened the windows.
It does sound like you wanted to take chances, Jane. You wanted to see what was out there, especially in London after leaving Wales. Presumably you didn't go back to live in Wales. You've always lived in London. And now, of course, you live in Cambridge.
That's right. Yeah, just outside Cambridge. We moved up here about 20 years ago. So now I've been in Cambridge for longer than I was in London. But yeah, I love being in London. I mean, it was just great, absolutely great.
Do you think that there are the chances nowadays for young people to do the kind of thing that you did back then? Or do you think things have changed now and it's not quite so easy?
I don't think it is as easy. And I think one of the reasons is because it seems to me that rents are so high, or mortgages. But even if, I mean, places I lived in London... and I lived in some really nice areas. The rent was never that high. So you could live quite cheaply. I mean, some of my friends lived in squats and things. In fact, I was watching this film the other night called Tramps. It's one of the BFI, on the BFI Film Institute. And there were lots of people there talking about that, you know, creatives and people who'd lived through that era as I had. And that's what they were all saying, was that, you know, the opportunities now are difficult because everything's so much more expensive. You've got no money left over. You've got to have a serious job, I think. And particularly because, you know, these creative people, sometimes some of these houses in London, great big, you know, Georgian places, you know, with massive rooms. Beautiful, you know, and then you could do photography in there, or you could have fashion shows and parties and all this. And I think back and, you know, I mean, we all had to work and I don't think any of us were earning that much money, but we seemed to be able to enjoy ourselves a lot, go out a lot, do things. Nowadays, it's expensive to do it, isn't it?
It costs a fortune nowadays. We've kind of priced ourselves out of the market, really. You can only afford to go out once in a blue moon to some of these big gigs, especially. I mean, you're talking about sometimes hundreds of pounds, whereas you used to be able to go out for about £9-10 or less.
Mm. Well, exactly. Yeah. I think it's a shame. But I guess it's different, isn't it? Because you've got social media now. So marketing your stuff, selling your stuff now, it's so much easier to do online. I mean, we used to have to print off little flyers or things like that. I mean, there was a lot of legwork to do. If you wanted, obviously you could make a phone call, but if I wanted to sell some clothing, often, you know, you'd have to get an appointment, go and see the person. You know, you couldn't send them photographs online of your stuff. That wasn't going to happen.
That's very true. It is true.
When we did press releases, you know, we'd have to have hard copies of the photographs because we did a few fashion shoots and things, and then you'd have to send the hard copies in to a magazine.
And now, Jane, I really want to touch on your appearance. Now, I know people don't like to talk about appearances, but I really want to touch on yours because I have viewed lots of your photographs. Every time I look at them, it's lush. You have different hairstyles, different colours, different clothes. It looks like different eras as well. I mean, that must be quite liberating to be able to change your look. Do you find that really is quite an invigorating moment for you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I like having my hair different colours. I mean, it's blonde at the minute, but, you know, I've had extensions in it. It's been black, you know, well, it's been red. It's about having fun, I think, with clothing as well. Not being too serious about it, you know, and not keeping things for best, not thinking, oh, well, gosh, you know, I've got that net skirt, but, you know, where am I going to wear that? I can only wear it out to an evening event or something. Well, how many of us do that? So, I think, well, I just wear it when I'm walking the dog. Why not? You know?
That's great. Honestly, I mean, absolutely.
I'm exactly like that, you know, exactly. I have things in the cupboard that really I never, ever wear, or I wear once or twice. It's such a waste, isn't it? You're absolutely, you've got the right idea, really.
You have.
Well, also, those are things that you've probably spent quite a bit of money on as well. That's the thing. So the danger, I think, is buying something for a special occasion, because often I think then, you know, it's something that you wouldn't wear again. When I mean, I don't buy many clothes, obviously, because I've got so many rails here. If I want something, I can just come downstairs and just take something off the rail, can't I? Wear it and then put it back on again. I'm always walking around with a price tag on me, actually, just in case, you know. You never know. If somebody likes it, it's always for sale.
The walking model. I love it. Absolutely love it. So let's get back on to Trash Chic then, because this sounds a really interesting concept, Jane, in the sense that I've been reading snippets here where you've said the word samey does not enter your vocabulary. You don't want to be samey. You want to be extraordinary, eccentric and individual. And is that how your clients see this as well?
Well, I think so. What I love about my rails is that there's so many different styles on there. There's so many different colours. There's unusual things that I've picked up. So it's not like going into a high street store where, you know, you've got a season, so there's a trend. It's stuff that's quirky. It's high street. I mean, I have got some designer stuff, but, you know, a lot of it is high street. As long as it's secondhand and it's being moved on, I think it's great. I've got a lot of sequins on the rails, which, to be honest with you, I was never much of a sequin person, but I had to get a load for an event last year, and I've kind of got into them now. So I've got lots of like sequin bomber jackets and things. And I do like that sort of boho festival look, really.
Yeah. And I understand that you have opinions about people of a certain age, women of a certain age, being restricted in what they wear.
Well, you know, there's a lot of articles, isn't there, on social media, things coming up about, you know, what you should and what you shouldn't be doing. And I just think it's such a damn cheek.
Yeah, it, I mean, is.
You know, I think, you know, wear what you feel comfortable in. Now, a lot of people don't want to go around wearing sequins, and absolutely fine. But if you do, why not? And just because you're over 60, you know, that suddenly it's like, oh, well, you know, you've got to be what, you know, all serious about clothes. And
I don't know. Get that cardigan on. Yeah.
I don't know many people like that. But I think there are a lot of women out there who, as they get older, you know, their body shape changes. You know, maybe they're not working, or maybe they've changed jobs, and they start to feel a little bit insecure about things, and about, and, you know, maybe get a little bit lost sometimes and feel, oh, I've kind of lost my mojo. I think it happened to a lot of people through COVID. I mean, I found myself slobbing around in walking trousers all the time, because that's what we were doing. You know, that's all we could do, really, was go out for a walk. And then I just realised, you know, that I'd been living in those and walking boots and nothing else. So then coming out of that, I suddenly, well, you know, I need to get back into wearing all my fun things again. I'm sure for a lot of women that can happen, where you sometimes just need a little bit of a helping hand, perhaps, or maybe a bit of excitement as well, so that, you know, you're not going into a shop this season, this is the trend, and you know what, it doesn't really suit me, or I don't feel happy wearing it, and then there's nothing for you to buy. In the past, I've often gone shopping up into town with some money, thinking, oh, I'd like something new or pre-loved, and just not finding anything, and then feeling very disillusioned. Whereas the majority of people, women, who come and shop with my stuff, I think, are always amazed how many really, really cool things I've got, and that, you know, they haven't seen anywhere else. Been hiding in people's wardrobes, you know.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Not being worn.
I'm really interested in your view on fashion designers, for the fashion we have now, the relationship between fashion houses and your fashion houses, your way of actually reusing and reinventing our clothes. I know there is a place for both, but are you fighting against fashion houses, or do you think you're trying to work with them?
Oh, I would say definitely work with them. I mean, I don't have a problem with people buying new clothes. And I think fashion houses, if they're producing really interesting things or sustainable, I mean, it's hard to be very sustainable, to be honest with you. And it does make stuff costly. But I think the thing that worries me about all this is the quantity of clothes that seems to be produced by some of these fast fashion brands like Shein and places like that, because it is huge. And I don't see that people need to have that many clothes. When they're that cheap, people end up buying too many. So to me, it's all about the quantity and influencers as well. I mean, I don't know whether I should be saying this, really. I mean, you know, I might get myself into trouble. But you see some influencers, they're usually young women, you know, on the socials, showing how, you know, how much of this stuff they're buying. Oh, you know, they've got packages coming in and, oh, this only cost me £3, etc. And I think, are they aware that somebody is paying the price for this? Not them. They've only paid £3 for it. But some poor devil sitting at a sewing machine, you know, locked into a factory or a warehouse somewhere, is earning peanuts. Mm. And, you know, and I think that's, I mean, to me, that's just wrong.
I agree. And really, there's no excuse for it nowadays, because I think we are all made aware of that quite frequently, actually, that there's a lot of exploitation goes on in the rag trade.
So... Oh, definitely, definitely. And I think there is a move away from that, but I don't know. It's not going to happen overnight, is it, really? You see, this is a difficult thing for me, because basically I want to sell clothes. I mean, that's how I'm going to have to be earning a living from now on. So I want to sell to people, but... Part of my mantra as well is buy less. So it's a bit contradictory, isn't it, really?
Or swap. So maybe one in, one out, that kind of thing. Mm. That's another way of doing it, isn't it?
To me, I just feel as though, you know, there's enough clothes on the planet, but they're not always in the right wardrobe.
Yeah.
So
that's really interesting. That's a good sentence.
Yeah,
actually.
That's what I've been saying, because I think, you know, people can... You know, they can go through their wardrobes, they can bring stuff out, pass it on, and then they can get something new, pre-loved, you know, new to them, and feel good about it as well.
I do love clothes. It's something that I've been brought up to love. My aunt lived in New York, and in the 50s, it was all about what you wore, how you walked on the high street and how you moved on the high street in New York. And I got a sense of that when she came over occasionally to see us. But for future generations and for people of our age as well, how can we change our attitude towards clothes? Is that something you're trying to get across for Trash Chic?
Yes, I think I am. And I think really it does come down to basically the quantity of stuff you're buying. Mm. So, you know, if you are going to buy something, think about, well, have I already got that item in my wardrobe? How many of those items have I got? How many do I need? If you fancy buying something, maybe even just don't buy it right there. Don't buy it as an impulse. Just think on it for a few days, perhaps, you know, because sometimes the longing will go away. And you realise, you know, that perhaps you don't need that. Definitely, I think, to rationalise your wardrobe, to look at what you've got and to try and perhaps mix up the clothes you've got, to make different outfits out of them. So you haven't got stuff sat there not doing anything and you're going out buying more and then ending up in the same situation of, you know, oh, gosh, I still haven't got anything to wear. And we all do that, don't we?
Oh, yeah, we do.
You know,
we've got bulging wardrobes. Absolutely.
But I think it is all about the quantity that we buy, really. I think that to me is the issue.
Note to self. I've got enough long black skirts to last a lifetime. Stop buying more, because that's what I'm really bad for. But you know, Jane, I used to love going into charity shops because I'd find really quirky and unusual things in there. I don't seem to find that in charity shops anymore. Or is that just me getting older and not recognising quirky anymore?
No, it's not you. It's very, very difficult, actually. I mean, I'm in the charity shops a lot. The people that like to shop there, you know, people like myself and you, the thing about going in there is that you want to find that hidden gem, don't you? It's a hunt. That's what I love.
Well, I love the way for you to change your appearance because it's what you want to do. It's very liberating. And I can see a picture here of you with your lovely blonde hair. And you've got these wonderful glasses on, these sunglasses, mirror sunglasses, and a floral dress and this beautiful voile cardigan on the sleeves. And it looks incredible. So I think people need to realise that you can look amazing without having to buy new clothes.
Well, absolutely. And it can be very affordable, which is great. One of the other things I really want to do is to make sure that I don't charge too much for my clothes. Obviously, I've got to make money from it. but I don't want things to get too expensive, because sometimes some people selling secondhand stuff, I feel it can be a little overpriced. I don't want to do that. I want to keep the prices fair, because then I think people are willing to take a chance on something.
I love your website. It's trashchic.co.uk. You can find lots of things on there to buy as well, actually. And you can see that the prices are really reasonable. I'm looking at a pair of wide leg trousers at the moment, and £12. I mean, really reasonable for that. And lovely stuff on here. But you also have more on your website, don't you? Because there's lots of ideas, and there's a blog, and ideas to be sustainable at Christmas, like using scarves as wrappers, which I thought was a great idea.
Yeah, I like having the blog and stuff there. And I mean, I'm very active on my socials, obviously, you know, maybe putting advice out, or, yeah, picking up, you know, really on what other people are saying about, you know, about pre-loved as well, because it's a big thing at the minute, isn't it? Going forward, what I'm trying to do is to sort of collaborate more with other people. Because I think, you know, there's a lot of very interesting ideas, a lot of interesting creators and makers, certainly around Cambridge. So that's my sort of plan for this year, to try and reach out and find other like-minded people like myself. It all has to be sort of upcycled or sustainable in some way, and try and do events together.
Jane, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. It really has. It's so nice to speak to someone like you, who literally wants to move forward and make this world a better place, in the sense of us feeling good about ourselves at the same time as doing good as well, in trying to push for reinvention and old clothes being your new clothes, basically. And it's wonderful. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
That's all we have time for today on Women Making Waves. Our thanks go to our guests, Joanna Borrett and Jane Horwood. We're always on the lookout to feature women living extraordinary lives, so please do contact us if you know of someone we should be talking to.
You can contact us via social media on X and Facebook at WomenMW, or on Instagram at Women Making Waves. You can also find us on cambridge105.co.uk, or visit our website, womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.